true, that spiritual, actual, factual answers to questions he asking. You find them inside you, beside you, reciting the records of Kashuk. We laughing, we drafting the passion through fabric. It's time for that comedy, dramedy, all of the fanciest, catchiest acronyms. Listeners, listen, we traveling. Consciousness is always unraveling. The reading you're having is mapping you back to your natural habitat. Abracadabra, it's magic, let's pass it. To top it off, the host are the classiest. Now, what were you asking for? All of the answers, what? All the answers.
Your hair looks insane.
Does it? It's just that it's poking out underneath my my headphones, and it's I have a high hairline, so I can't really like.
But now it looks perfectly great. That was the easiest fix in the world.
Oh, you know why? Because I just tucked it back in, so now I just have a giant forehead.
You know, it's funny. I hear that. I don't see that. I don't see it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but
well, let me look at myself in big. Oh no, I don't. You're right. In small, who cares? Why did this? Well, this is how we started?
Oh, good. It's just funny. What I was going to say about it is like how we all have these things. We look at ourselves and we're like, look at that giant whatever or that teeny tiny.
Yeah.
And someone else is like, oh, okay, maybe.
No.
Yeah. I'm like, does that ever, do you ever get rid of that? And I think the answer is no.
Probably not. You know, or, I mean, probably what you can do is like heal the part of you that is reactive to it.
Yeah, I feel pretty like good about like, eh. I don't you think too, like everybody always said this when I was younger and I didn't believe them or I thought it was lame or I had judgments of it that like women would always say like, ah, that's just because I'm older. Once you're 40 something, you don't give a fuck anymore. And I always thought like, okay, sure. But like some of that's true. Like age happens and you're like, I got bigger fish to fry. Like this is what I am.
Yeah.
I look how I look. Like get on board or don't, America. I can't help you if you're upset about it, you know?
Yeah.
We have a guest for the first time in a long ass time.
A year. Not true, but a long, long ass time. Yeah, that's exciting. We're going to be talking to
an author of an Enneagram book and a reverend of some kind.
Yeah. Who does like massive amounts of Enneagram stuff all over the world and conferences and things.
Is that right? I didn't even know that.
I just went to the website.
Good job.
Yeah, I did a little research. How about you? You're the one who brought her to us.
I looked at the book a bunch and that's all. That's all I did.
Awesome.
That's cool. That's awesome.
Talking to them later.
Yeah, bunch of stuff. Now, from when we spoke last time, I remember having in my head 80 things again that I wanted to talk about. And I'm like, well.
Did you write them down?
Oh, yes, I did. Thank you for reminding me. Side note. While I pull this up, have you heard of the podcast Scam Factory?
Was it? Oh, no. I just saw it. I just literally saw it drop because I, for the listeners, I believe, if I'm not mistaken, Scam Factory is about the place where all those scam texts are generated from. And then it's like trafficked people who are trapped in a.
Correct.
In a,
yes.
I heard a podcast episode about that on another podcast that I love. And so I kind of have the backstory.
Was the other one Scamfluencers?
No, it wasn't a scam thing at all. It was an internet thing. It was a podcast about like weird internet and tech shit.
Oh, interesting.
And so someone, you know, people approach them with questions like, what's the deal with? And so they like did the research and found out.
What's it called?
That one I think was on, it was either on Reply All, which is no longer, or it was on the one, I have to look it up on my podcasts, Search Engine.
Okay.
It's either on Search Engine or on Reply All.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah, well, I've been listening to it this weekend and I just want to do a little shout out. Like if you need a terrifying real life horror show of true crime terribleness that's also like hope inducing by the end,
ooh,
strong recommend. Because like who in your life is not getting these fucking texts. Hi.
Hi.
How are you today?
Hey, I didn't see you at the picnic this weekend.
Right. Were you going to come later?
Do you want to golf?
They say that?
I've gotten requests to golf. I've gotten just hi, hello. And if you respond, you will always get, oh my God, I'm so sorry, but you seem nice.
Yep. Every time. But like I have to say like on a business level, like on a marketing level, I'm impressed. They are reaching all of us.
Yeah.
They're reaching all of us. And the way they're doing it is fucked up. Like manipulating families into getting literally lying to them and saying like, hey, there's work for you over here. It's good work to people in the Philippines, for example, who don't have, there's not a lot of industry in the Philippines. So if any job shows up where you can make $1,000 a month, they're like, okay, get this. Then you go to a place that is a fake location and they show you like, this is where you'll be working and you'll be doing customer service for whatever. And then you come to day one of the work and they put you on a bus and they're like, we're going to take you to the building. And they just take you thousands of miles away across a river to Myanmar and enslave you. Guys with guns, the whole thing.
And then force you to churn out these they call them pig fattening schemes.
Right.
Or pig butchering schemes. Pig butchering schemes. They fatten up the pig, which is you.
Yeah.
And then they get butchered when you steal all your money.
Yeah. Yeah. And they don't want to be doing it.
No.
The majority of people there are just can't, they'll be killed or beaten or starved. They starve them.
I used to respond to them with like, go fuck yourself.
Yeah.
You're a terrible human. And now I respond with, I'm sorry for your circumstances.
Yeah.
I hope you can
Same.
Find something.
I recently said to one of them, they said, hi. And my first sentence was, after listening to the podcast, I'm assuming you've been trafficked into having to do this. And I'm really sorry that's happening to you. I wish there was something I could do to help. Let me know if I can.
Jeez.
Could I like text you some money? Like, what do you want?
Right.
How can I help you? Because you are in a fucked
Where's
situation.
Your location? Can I send
Right.
international? Can I
I'm gonna
send international police or something?
I'm going to start telling them, hey, there's a podcast out about what's happening to you. And just so you know, there's some people who care trying to help.
Yeah.
I mean, it's fucked up. It's like a real thing. And I want to talk about it because I want to do any kind of awareness raising I can do. These people are, and it's affecting all of us in America who have all these means and all this money. You know, if you have $1,000 in your checking account, that's like a big deal to someone in the Philippines.
Yeah.
Anyway, that happened. Okay. Now here's my list of things to talk about.
Okay.
And then let's have you pick what you want to discuss.
Can I just, like, if you read them off, can I just go, yep, nope.
Sure.
Yay.
But, like, try to actually think about it.
Okay.
Like, I'd like a real opinion, not a joke one.
No, but I'm going to feel it in my gut. So that's where it's going to be coming.
Oh, okay. Right we're going to do sacral practicing.
Oh, man.
Okay. What I did to B's marriage, do I regret it?
You froze up on my end.
You want me to come back to you?
Nope, you're back.
Oh, I was here the whole time.
I never left you. That's when I was carrying you.
Footprints in the sand. What I did to marriage, do I regret it?
It's great. I love it.
Yep. Why can't I be that kind of psychic?
Interesting. An extension of a previous conversation.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
We kind of covered it. Physical stuff is always emotional.
We have covered it, but always happy to revisit.
Yeah, there's more there though. So, okay, we got a yes on the first one.
Yeah, that was just because it's juicy.
Totally. It's totally juicy. All right. Let's talk about this.
Is name?
Yeah.
And you don't care. You're just like, his name is.
Well, let's bleep it, I guess.
Okay. And
sorry,
from
everyone.
Now on, it's Darren.
Sean.
Whatever you want it to be.
Darren Sean. So, all right. We're going to relate this to the Enneagram. Watch. Okay. So I'm 20 something. I've just graduated. No, that's not right. I'm 20 something. I've graduated college in Massachusetts. I've lived in New York for a year. I've come back to Miami, Florida. I've gone to treatment for an eating disorder. I'm freshly out of treatment and I'm trying to find a place to live that isn't my mother's house. So it's not the brightest time in my life, but.
And which city are you in now?
Miami, Florida.
Okay.
I'm also sort of like full of hope for the future at the same time. Somehow I just feel like the world is my oyster. It's going to be great. I'm going through hard stuff, but like, whatever. It's just stuff I'm going through. I'm going to get through it and write my show and take over the world. I find a place. I don't remember how this came about. Maybe through a friend. Oh, I know. I went to the Landmark Forum.
Oh.
I did Landmark and I met a dude.
All right.
Wait, Darren Sean.
Darren Sean.
Darren Sean.
Darren Sean.
Okay.
So you went to half a cult.
I went to mostly a cult and met a nice gentleman named Darren Sean, that's not his name. And we became immediate friends. We just hit it off right away. He had, I'm sorry for this, white guy dreads.
I'm sorry too.
Let's hold for a moment of silence to acknowledge how horrible that is. At the time, though, everybody at fucking Landmark was just like cookie cutter normal guy stuff. So he stood out because he looked like he was at least making a choice about something. And at the time, I didn't understand white guy dreads were so gross.
So he looked like Shifty Shell Shock from Crazy Town?
I don't know what any of those words are.
A Come, my lady, come, come, my lady. You're my butterfly, God. Sugar baby.
That's horrifying. He probably did look like that guy.
Yeah.
Okay, so we hit it off. We become friends. He's got a room in his house for rent, and I need a place to live. And he's married to a young woman. We'll call her Frances. And so I move in with Darren, Sean, and Frances.
Frances. It's a long A.
Frances. The shortest way to tell the story is I become friends with both of them, but I was friends with him first, and he was a really good dude. Like, I really liked him as a person. We would go get coffee in the morning. He'd be on his way to his job. He worked as a sound engineer somewhere, and I was, like, teaching acting and trying to do, I was writing this solo show and trying to, whatever, figuring out what I wanted to do next. Shortly after this, I applied to grad school and moved to California. But anyway, we're friends. We go to Dunkin' Donuts in the morning. We're getting closer and closer. We're really good friends. We have a fun time. Then his wife and I start to become friends separately because their schedules were different. So she and I would be at the house a lot at the same time, or the apartment, just hanging out. And I get to know her. Well, one night, randomly, she and I are watching TV at night. It's like somewhere between 6 and 8 p.m. I mean, out of nowhere. Let's see. I'm trying to remember how the conversation came up. Anyway, I said something like, we're watching a show, and I said, well, you guys bone in that room over there. I was making fun of, like, we all live in close quarters and right. They have sex right next to me. And we're watching some sexual reference on a TV show. Well, you guys are boning right next door. And she was like, eh. And I go, what do you mean? Eh. And she goes, you know, I let him do it sometimes.
Oof. Oh.
And I said,
that makes my back hurt.
I said, what do you mean you let him do it sometimes? She's like, ugh, I mean, you know, he wants to. I let him do it. It's fine. And I had a moment of clarity. Every time she and I had been in her car is covered in rainbow paraphernalia. Rainbow on the rearview mirror. Rainbow sticker on the back. Rainbows inside the house. And it just clicked in my brain. I went, are you gay? And she was like, yeah. And I was like, you guys are married though, right? And she was like, yeah. And I go, okay, how is that for you? She's like, that's fine. We're really good friends. He's my best friend, you know? And I was like, great, okay. But so the sex part doesn't bother you that, like, do you want to have sex with him? She's like, I mean, I let him do it. And I'm like, doesn't that feel bad? She's like, I mean, I don't know. Okay, end of, that's the inciting incident.
Okay.
I want to pause because I understand.
It's a complicated story, but I feel it. It makes that framing is what's painful. Is like I let him do it. Is where like it feels violating. It feels very like ugh.
Yeah, like she clearly doesn't want to, isn't into him in that way, but she's leading him to believe she is because she lets him fuck her.
Yeah, and that just feels not great.
Right.
And for both of them.
Right. Now, I'm pausing because for anybody listening who may have had unique marriage arrangements at any time in their lives.
Yeah.
I am not speaking to that piece. If people together consciously choose whatever the fuck they consciously choose.
Right. And agree to it. And it's out there and we're clear with
everybody has talked about it and we've agreed to the terms. That's like, hallelujah, live your fucking life. But I had just learned my buddy was, I thought, not in the marriage he thought he was in.
Yeah.
He was talking to me about, you know, she's the love of my life and we're best friends and I love her so much and we'll be together forever. And I heard, I mean, he's in love with her.
Yeah.
And she's letting him do it. Okay, now here's where it gets dicey.
All right, and this is where you may have made an ethical moral judgment.
Here's where a Katie Rubinism occurred.
Okay.
This was many years ago.
Okay.
I was 22. You know, I sit with this for a few days and it's bugging me. And we're going to coffee, he and I, every day after this. And I'm just like, I mean, it's their life. It's none of my business. But, and then I'm at coffee with him and he's like, yeah, she's so great. Oops. What did I say her name was?
Forgot. Oh, okay.
Frances. Frances is the, she's so praising her, can't stop about, and also the sex and how good it is. And I'm just like, my head is exploding. So one day I make the choice to tell him.
Yeah.
I say, I can't keep standing here. I go to coffee with you. We're good friends. I need to tell you this thing that happened. She said this thing. Okay, that's it. I'm out. But that's what happened. So I tell him, she said I let him do it. I'm going to pause so you could judge me.
That's for them.
Anybody can.
Yeah.
The listener. Yeah. Like, but let's pause for real. Like, already, how is this landing for you?
No, it's a common story. Some version of this is a common story. The version that usually occurs is you have to tell him because if you don't, I will.
Right.
But that part wasn't there because you don't have that relationship with her.
Yeah.
But that's the thing with like cheating or whatever, people are always, and then finally they don't tell them and then that person says it. So like a version of this has happened in the past, but this is a hard one because I can imagine you just dropped a really painful truth bomb on a friend.
That's right. Also, in the initial conversation with me and Frances, I had said to her, does it feel like out of fairness to him, you should probably tell him you're not into sex with him?
Yeah.
Like I said that to her.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And she was like, no, nah, he's fine. We're good. He doesn't even care. He doesn't even think about it. And I'm just like, that feels like it's taking for granted that he's a human who is in a different reality than you. And he doesn't know the deal he's in.
Yeah.
Okay. Time goes by. All the coffees, he's praising her. I tell him. By the way, we are buddies, and that is all. I have never once thought of him in any way other than like, this is the bro who lives in the house I'm renting a room in.
Yeah.
Except we're like buddies. He confronts her. I'm not there when it happens. He confronts her. He moves out. They have a huge fight. He's not okay with it at all.
Yeah.
He's really glad I told him. He's devastated. He was in a band at the time, and his band goes on tour. And while he's on
Third Eye Blind,
little band called that you may have heard, the Smashing Pumpkins.
Three Doors Down. I'm going with the mid hits.
He goes on tour and he's texting me the whole time his process. He's like, I can't believe this. My marriage is over. He's telling me about how the conversation went and she just didn't have anything to say. And I asked her if she was straight up gay and she told me she was. And I said, why did you think I knew that? And she was like, because of all the rainbows everywhere. And he was like, I didn't fucking know. I thought you were just like an ally supporting people. And this was, by the way, in the, like the 90s, the early aughts. So it wasn't even a thing to be an ally formally. Anyway, he's on tour. The tour ends. He comes back and he moves out of their house. In the meantime, while he's on tour, I move out with a quickness. Because I'm like, cool, just broke up a marriage. I'm going to go ahead and go. Because I don't want to be around. She is not happy with me. I move out. Now, interesting timing in my life. My mother, God. Well, anyway, my mother and father had gotten divorced a couple years before. She had moved into a new condo a few blocks away. So my childhood home was empty and being sold. So I slept on my childhood bedroom floor.
Wow.
By myself in the house because I had nowhere else to go. And I was like young and bohemian and I don't care. I just live on the streets or wherever and I'm artsy and that's cool. I look back at it now and I'm like, man, my situation was sad.
Yeah.
Like, what about staying with your mom in her new house down the street? She's got rooms and beds. Nope. She and I were not good. And so I slept on the floor of an empty house. Cut to, his tour ends. He comes back. He moves out. He's staying with a friend or something. And he's like, do you want to hang out? And I'm like, sure. And he comes over to my house, my empty childhood home, and we hook up.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't look good.
Nope.
No.
No. Now, this is months after they've split up.
Okay.
It's months later. He's been on tour a long time. He comes back. It's months later. And we have this hookup and I'm just like, And I hadn't even thought of him that way. Suddenly he was like a cute guy in my house. And I was like, oh. And he was single and he was going through a divorce and he was there.
Yeah.
And I liked him. So we hook up. Time goes by and we start dating. We then proceed to fall madly in love.
Okay.
I mean, if I could remember it better, I would... I have such terrible memory. But I felt so close to him. We had so much fun. He was a really fun boyfriend and a really nice guy. I get into grad school in California. So I'm like working retail and teaching acting and I'm going to drive cross country. And he says, can I go with you? And we're like in a thing now, for real. We're like together. And I was very intimacy avoidant, very afraid of, I didn't want anybody clinging to me and I didn't like being, you know, crowded. And I was just very like, don't ask me for stuff. So he says, can I come across the country? And I'm like, I need a few days to think about that. I think about it. I come back and I go, you can come, but I want to be very clear. You should come for yourself because I don't know where this is going with you. I'm not ready to like commit. But if you want to get in my car and we can go together, sure. Which, when I say that now, I'm like, what a dick I was. What a sad little dick. But at least I was clear. I was happy with myself. I was like, I'm telling him the truth. I don't want to mislead anybody. We take this road trip. We have a super fun time. We stop in his hometown, which I won't name. We meet his parents.
Okay.
We move in together when we get to California, in the town where I went to grad school, to Davis. I have an apartment that I've already established from Florida. I already got it set up. He moves in with me and I'm like, hey, I need this to be like, you're staying here while you find a place, not like we live together. Cause I just was not able to do together time. He stayed with me a while. He got his own place. He moved out. I fell down. I start grad school. I fall down a 15-foot hole backstage and I injure my left shoulder. The entire left side of my body doesn't move. I'm in bed for 3 months. Like, I got really hurt. I'm still healing that one these days, to this day. We sort of stop having sexy time. He brings it up. He's like, are we going to bone ever again? And I'm like, I don't know. We should probably break up. He's like, okay. And then in about a week and a half, he was engaged to be married to someone else.
What?
Like, very quickly after, he was
engaged.
Engaged to be married. This was a...
Okay, so had he met this person prior?
No, he met a girl in California after I dumped him. Now, we were together like a year or something. We had like a long-term thing that I had commitment.
But he met her and got engaged in a week.
Well, okay, it may not have been a week. It might have been a month.
Okay.
It was like a very short amount of time.
Yeah.
Maybe 2 months.
Yeah.
And I knew this because I don't know, a few months after we broke up, I had like regret and like was like, hey, I'm sorry that I was so afraid of intimacy. I reached out or something and a friend of his, I don't know, somehow through the grapevine, I learned he was engaged and he was moving to Seattle or Portland or something. So the point is, this was a guy who wanted to be married. This was a married guy. This is a guy who met his high school sweetheart, who was gay. He married her. He was with me. He was like, let's get married. And I was like, I got to date 90 people. And then the next lady that came along, she wanted to get married too. So they did that.
Do you know if they're still together?
They're not. And then he got married again after her.
Okay.
Like they got married.
Yeah.
Then they got divorced.
Yeah.
Then he got married again.
Yeah.
It's the guy who likes to be married in his 20s. Okay. To each their own. So the question is, how did I write it down? What I did to Darren Sean, do I regret it?
I guess the question is for Katie. Do you regret it?
No, but I want to hear your take first.
I mean, ultimately, you actually did. You operated in the spirit of truth. You weren't trying to sabotage. Your motivation was not, I want to get with this guy. So you weren't being evil. You just told him a truth that he was avoidant to hear.
Yep.
That he probably should have known, but didn't know because he was, I mean, that last little nugget actually kind of brought it full circle.
Yep.
He wanted to be married so bad that he was willing to.
That's right.
Overlook anything that was possibly in the way of that. She probably was into the security of it or the that's just fineness of it.
Yep.
And I understand that too. I absolutely understand that feeling.
Right.
It's the safe choice. It's the easy choice. It's the like, well, I don't want to make waves. And if it just means having to do this thing that's not god awful, it's just meh. It sounds like it was meh to her. But forcing yourself to do something meh, it takes a toll over time, mm-hmm. which is what most people do in their work life all the time.
Yeah.
They force themselves to do something meh for years and years.
Yeah, for sure.
So I don't know. My takeaway is I don't think you committed an evil. You actually committed a bit of an aggressive truth bomb.
That sounds right. Sounds on brand.
Yeah, sounds like a Katie.
Well, I thank you for that. I appreciate the generosity of that interpretation. I feel conceptually like I agree with you. And there's another part of me, this is why this came up, obviously, that at this point in my life, I wonder what I would choose.
Mm.
Like if you had a friend now and you're however old you are.
Yeah.
And you found out that one of the partners is like, I let him do it.
Oof.
And you're real close with the other one.
God.
What do you do?
Yeah, you're close with the hard part is like.
That's right.
The person that you would really want to call out is not the one you have that intimate relationship with.
And I called her out. It didn't matter. She didn't care.
Yeah.
I asked her a question. Don't you feel like he would want to know that da da da? No, he doesn't. And I was like, I can't abide.
Yeah. I mean, it's a devastating thing to learn because there's so much tied up in that. It's not just the, oh, I didn't know. There's also the shame, the embarrassment, the, ew, I'm gross to her, but she lets me do it or whatever.
Exactly.
There's the thing that, I mean, there's so much in that for a person. Like I have.
So what would you do?
I have experienced that. I mean, I, like you said, he was glad you told him.
Right.
Absolutely. Most of the time we learn that to know the truth is better. Most of the time.
Yep.
To know the truth is better.
Well, I believe in that theoretically.
Yeah, because living the lie is spiritually toxic.
But so that's a nice abstract example. But what would you do in real life? Like it's Jeff. It's your friend Jeff. Or it's me. And Eric says to you one random day, I let her bone me. And you're like, Katie's in a relationship where he's letting her bone him. Do you tell me?
Yeah, I tell you, but I know you in a way that's, yeah. Ooh. Yeah, I think I do. It kind of goes back to the thing we started with. Like, I'm over 40. Like, I don't fucking have time for this shit. And you don't have time for this shit. I don't want you living badly.
Okay, so you would tell.
Yeah, now that I mention it, I have a pair of friends who have a dead bedroom and they do not discuss it.
Okay.
If anything, maybe they've agreed to not discuss, but I don't even think it's gone that far.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the I let him do it part. It's the we don't even broach the subject.
Right.
And I want to say, I'll say to him, because I'm closer with him, like, that makes me really sad. I wish you guys would at least talk about it and at least acknowledge it.
Yeah.
At least, like, come to, and even if it's not going to change, just say, like, that makes me sad, or express the feeling that goes between it.
Yeah.
But that'll never happen. And I will never say anything to her about it.
Right.
Never. I will never say anything to her about it.
Well, that's a different deal, right?
Yes. But I mean, there is an unspoken, I don't know if it's a lie. There's a lack of clarity between them. There's a big, huge, jagged, painful, there's an elephant in the room that's got like giant spikes on it that people are like.
And you're choosing to not bring it up, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it's not mine to bring up. So
that's the debate. I'm going to let our guest in. Sorry to cut you off.
That's all right. This is the question.
So I just think it's an interesting topic. And I wonder, listeners, what you think. Email us at allanswerspod@gmail.com.
Do you regret it? Final answer.
Oh, me?
Yeah.
It's complicated. Yes and no.
Okay.
Mostly no. Hello.
Are you there? Oh, yes. I see a video coming on. Hello.
Hello. I'm here.
How's it going? Welcome here.
Why am I not hearing you?
I don't know.
Not hearing us, not hearing us.
You can hear us now?
Yes.
All right. Hi.
Hello. Great to see you. Great to meet you. Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you for being here.
This is like a blind date, isn't it? We kind of all got thrown into a room together.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks for being here. We were talking briefly about you before some other things we talked about, and we were talking about you, basically, I'll say a little bit about what I understand that you do, but then I'd love to hear your better words about it since you're you and you know what you do. But you're an Enneagram, we could say, expert. You travel around teaching and talking about the Enneagram. You've written a book called The Soul of the Enneagram, and you have the moniker Reverend in front of your name. So I'm assuming there's some training that leads to said title, and you're here talking to us, and we're so lucky to have you. What is your better framing of what you do than what I just
said? And also, will you please introduce your actual self, your name, which we have not said yet today?
Oh, yes. And are we on air?
We are. Well, we're not live, but we are recording.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, no, we edit. So anything can be taken out that you want to have taken out.
Okay, wonderful. Yeah. So where do I start? Well, I have to say that, you know, among, quote, Enneagram experts, there's a saying that those who call ourselves experts are not the experts, right? So I call myself an Enneagram expert. I am a lifelong student for sure, am in the Enneagram, but I have been studying the Enneagram since 2002 and teaching it since 2007, approximately. Yeah. So it's been a while now. And so yes, I also teach the Enneagram around the globe. But I would say that it's almost like for me, what's primary is spirituality. And like that being the core of like how and why I show up like for people's conscious awakening, if you will. And so that being the Enneagram being a map that helps us to do that. But in my view, like the Enneagram is actually secondary. So yeah. So I want to leave with that and then go to the Reverend piece. Yes, it's a very bizarre story. So I don't know how much of it you want to hear, but I grew up in a Buddhist family. So that did not talk about religion whatsoever. So like we didn't grow up with any sense of like what you should believe or not believe, but nobody seemed to believe anything. But the weirdest, I was just the weird kid in general, read a lot of books and was always like searching for the meaning of life. That was like my story when I was a kid. I was like, some book is going to tell me this. And after decades and decades of searching, I did not find the answer in a book. Go figure. And I came to this understanding of well, I hit a bottom in my life and had a spiritual awakening. And through this like direct experience and this direct inquiry, I was like, oh, okay. And then through this spiritual awakening, I came across meditation. And through the practice of meditation, I started to open to this like fullness of being within myself. And that knowing, I was like, that's what I've been seeking my whole life. Like that connection to wholeness and to unity. And so at that point, at that moment, I was like, where do I go? I didn't have resources at the time. I found the teachings of A Course in Miracles, which led me to a unit.
Mm-hmm.
There I was, an antitrust litigator in San Francisco.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. At the time.
Yep.
So this is like a whole huge paradigm shift for me. But there's this thing happening inside of me. And so the Course in Miracles class was being held at a Unity church. And so I was like, what is this church? What is Unity? And so I found Unity through that. I fell in love with Unity because it taught me. I remember the woman in the first like introductory meeting, she was like, we don't care if you stay or leave. We're here for whatever part of your journey, like it resonates with us. I was like, that feels like love to me. That feels spacious and open and welcoming. And so I was hooked. And within like a year and a half, I became a volunteer prayer chaplain. And then one day after praying with people, I went out to the parking lot and I sat down and I had this moment like, I'm going to be doing this for the rest of my life. That was my call to ministry. So I left everything behind in San Francisco, went to the Midwest and became a licensed and ordained Unity minister.
Got it. Yes. I'm very familiar with the Unity Church, very familiar with that journey. That's fascinating. Now, why the Midwest?
Because Unity Seminary is here.
Ah, I see.
Yes.
And you're in Kansas City. Is that correct?
I am. I'm still here.
I read your website.
Great.
Okay. Are you in Kansas or Missouri?
I am. Oh, look at you. Missouri.
Lived there for 3 years. 100 years ago.
Oh, wow. Oh, yeah. Okay. Okay. So, you know, it's radically different here.
Yeah. I'm going Enneagram, very, you know, consciousness and meditation. I'm like, Kansas City. Okay. Interesting for that to be there, but cool.
Yes. But I mean, now we talk about it, it's the heart of America, you know, like,
okay.
I mean, and there is a renaissance, I believe, happening here. It's a really interesting thing, even in the arts, like the Nelson Atkins Museum. And there is just this like, yes, space for awakening. It's still minority, of course, but also very powerful, I think. Yeah.
Very cool. And so how did the Enneagram become a focus? I mean, there are so many systems of study about typing. I know what my love of the Enneagram comes for, and Cass and I talk about it all the time, and our friends talk about it all the time, and we love it. But I wonder what took you there.
Yeah. So basically, I had a crisis in my early 30s and in my marriage, and I basically separated from my husband, got a huge stack of books from the bookstore.
I thought you were going to say, I got a huge stack of money. Money. Divorce.
Money. That's
great.
What I thought too.
Just walked away with fat
cash.
Stacks. We're
cash
good.
Money.
I would have led me on a really different journey. So, no, not that. I'm still holding space. You never know what will happen in life, you know. But yeah, so continuing this sort of quest. So this is before I had my spiritual awakening, actually. So I had this And one of the books was on the Enneagram. And
which one?
It was actually one of Russ Hudson's, it's Hudson and Riso's like early book on the Enneagram, like that blue book.
Yep, I know. I was about to say, is it the blue one?
Yeah.
Yes. Yep. And yes. And the funny thing is, and the humility in all this is I actually misidentified myself initially. But back then, when I read the type one, like I cried. And back then, I mean, I cry a lot now, but I used to never cry. Like I was considered pretty cold, actually. I mean, attorney, like you do the thing, right? But the tears were like, the storyline of it was, you think something's wrong with you, you're trying to fix the world. And now, you know, I'm a three, I identify as a sexual three. There's a lot of commonality around ones and threes, of course, in the behavioral pieces of responsibility and hard work and all these things. But the thing that resonated at the moment as a one is that I had this weird thing where I didn't resonate with a three because I had such low self-esteem. They're like, threes are confident. And I'm like, not so much. No, I mean, I just felt the lowness of my being. And I'm like, one. And so, but that, those tears, ones were also described as always being right. And I was like, oh my God, I had to be right. And I realized the reason I had to be right is that being right somehow was if I wasn't right, then I felt like I would be fundamentally wrong.
Right.
That it wasn't okay.
Yeah.
And so I called my ex-husband and I was like, sorry. like I didn't know because I was right our whole relationship. I mean,
the Enneagram apology tour.
Yeah. You know, it is. So yes, the first thing I did was like this aha. So it was both like humiliating, you know, like and sad, but hopeful. Like the tears were like, oh, if there's a system that can actually name something so deep inside of me, like there's something here. And so that was the beginning. And that was before my spiritual awakening. And that's key because starting back then, I started a journey of understanding, of building empathy and understanding for the ways that I was and the ways that people in my life were through the Enneagram. But that only took me so far, the psychological piece. And then when I had the spiritual piece added in with meditation, that just catalyzed the healing and transformation of my journey. Things like the fact that I was the black sheep of my family. I mean, I honestly, it's like, I don't even know this person anymore. I didn't believe, if you told me your parents love you, I would have been like, BS. Like I would have not believed you through my 30s. Like and at that moment, that was true. And the healing that's happened, not just with my parents, but with my siblings, my relationship to myself, my relationship to life. It's the mingling of this Enneagram, which I realized we've been talking about the Enneagram and like the way I think of it isn't like the Enneagram is just a personality typing tool.
No, yeah, of course.
Yes. So holding the map of like consciousness in general.
All right. So that brings me to a question for you because you're in good company. I'm a big fan of Christopher Huertz's writing about the Enneagram because he's an eight. And so he speaks kindly about eights and like he is an eight. So he's writing about the Enneagram through the lens of the eight, which like a generous interpretation of an eight, like to hear it, somebody being like empathy for the things you've been through. I was like, ha, 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 you know, and this was like, for me, I've done every typing and every, I mean, there's just so much stuff I've done, but because of many crises, I envy you in having one crisis. That sounds admirable. Fair enough. Anyway, so I'm all about the Enneagram as it's so much deeper than, you know, one of my pet peeves about how people work with the Enneagram is when they go like, well, I'm a three, so that's what I do. And they just justify their shitty behavior because the Enneagram says that's how threes are. It's like, no, that's not how this is supposed to be used, bro. To wit, my question for you is, how would you, I have an answer to this, but I'd love to hear your words about this. And I'd love to share thoughts about it. How would you frame your idea about the relationship between the personality and the traits therein and the spiritual awakening that's possible inside of working with your type? Another way to say that would be, it's almost as if once we awaken and we meet consciousness, right? You could say the personality is all this, it's just noise. It's just static, right? And we've been identified with it as if it's who we are. But then you realize, no, I'm oneness and unity. Okay, so then what is the purpose of the personality and or how do we relate to the personality? What words do we use to describe it, given that we are not that? I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
Oh my God, this is like exactly what I teach on. So basically, I'll start by saying that starting with the symbolism of the circle of the Enneagram representing our wholeness, like, I feel like rather than start at personality, inviting meditation and reflection on that as the invitation to like, what is your wholeness? What is your authentic divine being? Like, oh, and holding that as something mysterious, you know, that our conscious minds don't even actually know the answer to that question yet, you know? And then when I draw that circle, then I talk about all the types being on the circumference of the circle, personality being on the surface of the totality of being, right? So there's a pictorial thing that can, you know, happen there. And yet just like the surface of the ocean, that drop of water on the surface of the ocean is no less deep than the drop of water at the bottom of the ocean, right? So it's not like there's anything lacking in that, right? There's a fullness of being in all of it, right? But living identified as that drop of water is living identified as the personality. And so, but since, you know, if you look at that circumference again, it's like, it's also the doorway. It, you know, and so that personality is like, this is the surface of me. That's the point of entry into the place of being, but in a way that doesn't demonize that, in a way that doesn't actually, like, there's no, in my work at Evolving Enneagram, it's all about Father Richard Rohr's Everything Belongs. That's so fundamental to what I practice and what I teach, which is that, like, can we even let the personality belong? And yet, when we're only identified with personality, there's this idea that if we want to go on the holy ideas, I can kind of get into that because that's related. Okay, first, I want to make a statement about in unity, we teach that the ego isn't bad, but like basically the personality, it's the self that believes it's separate from the whole. The self that believes it is, lives as if it is. And personality for me is that, right? And so, but the idea is then we don't, but then there's something to me very special about us being born. And I do believe that we're born having a predisposition to a certain Enneagram type, that being born with this, we're born with certain gifts, aptitudes. And that's not to be like disowned, actually. But imagine the efficiency of my threeness and the excellence of my threeness being used not in service to my own egoic competitive aims, but from this ground of being where I know that you and I, that we belong together. You know, that there's this interbeing that is the foundation of our existence. Imagine the skills of the personality being used in furtherance of that wholeness. In unity, we would call that individuality, the move from personality to individuality.
That's really good.
Right?
It's like the psychology term of transcend and include.
Yes.
Like in a sort of Buddhist psycho-spiritual language, we would say like, you want to transcend the personality and include it because it's not going anywhere. Like we go through, I think, people on a deeper, you know, if you're on a spiritual path at all and you have a big awakening and you meet the divine, then you go like, oh, it's all an illusion. So I'll just get rid of all that ugly personality stuff and just not have an ego, which of course you find as you travel forward is impossible. The ego is inescapable. So then you think, then you learn the idea of transcend and include, which is like use the ego in service of the spirit. Or you could say use the ego as the engine to live into the higher principles of spiritual principles or service to mankind or whatever you want to put it towards. Right. So it's that transcend and include idea.
Yes, 100%. And in fact, you know, the reason I was like, ooh, I'm going to just jump in is that we were just teaching Ken Wilber's integral theory in our Evolving Enneagram class, where I first learned transcend and include. And we've been using that as a mantra for everyone in the community for the last several weeks. And 100%, you know, that it's not, you know, it's not leave the ego behind, if you will. Right. Yes. So that's foundational. And it is what you're speaking to is when we talk about oneness, what we're talking about is non-duality, because we're talking about ego versus when you're, and we're eliminating that. We're saying identification with this part and then openness to being identified or knowing the wholeness of our full, I'd say, divine nature, you know, and that's just my terminology, right? What your authentic nature, whatever that is. Yeah. Yeah. So that is the journey that I invite people in all of our work at Evolving Enneagram, my personal work, but also the teachers that I work with as well. So yeah. So that's the core.
Yeah. Well, that's great. It's so nice to meet an Enneagram person who has walked so deeply with the work as you clearly have. It's really inspiring and beautiful. And Cass, just so you know, when we spoke, can you help me out? I forget how to pronounce your name.
My name, not Cass's.
your name.
My name, Katie. You've known me for 25 years.
Uh-huh. And tell me one more time.
Cassidy.
One more time.
Cass. Uh-huh. Cassidy.
With a K?
With a C.
Okay.
Brown.
And your name?
Nien.
Nien. Just wanted to speak correctly. So Cass, when Nien and I were emailing before yesterday or something, I had asked her if she'd be willing to talk about the holy ideal and the opposite of that, which I always forget the term for that, for each type briefly, just for our listeners. Just like if we could hit on it doesn't have to be an extensive, you know, you don't have to write a dissertation for us. I don't want to put you on too much of the spot. But if you'd be open to talking about that, I think that would be great for our listeners.
Yeah, yeah, I would love to. And so it's just more of like how extensive you want me to go, because like I could.
Basically, because we don't have too much time, we'll be here an hour together from when you came on, that, you know, just like a one-liner holy ideal and a one-liner opposite of that, and maybe a few words about that relationship, maybe per type, if that's something that doesn't feel too demanding or stressful or...
Not at all. Not at all. Yeah.
And we might then be inspired to discuss one of them more deeply, but okay. Absolutely. Let's just do this sort of the survey first.
Wonderful. And okay, let me try to think. So you don't need me to do a description of any of the traits of the type. Your listeners know that.
Well, I mean, we've talked through it all, but at the same time, you know, any words that come out of you that seem like they're relevant, if you're talking about the holy ideal, feel free, like whatever feels like it's going to help illuminate. And let me just say, just so this makes any kind of sense, the reason I'm asking this specific question is because I have found, you know, sitting with my type and my God, all the layers of unpeeling and unpacking that it has revealed over the years of sitting with it and look coming back. And what was that thing about the stuff? The thing that always anchors me in moments where I'm like, am I really an eight? It's like, yeah, bitch, because what anchors me in is that holy ideal and the opposite. What's it called? The opposite of the holy idea? The fixation.
Holy idea. And then fixation. Yes.
Great. Those guys, I'm always like, oh yeah, that's me. There it is. And so I find it very grounding for people as people who are listening, who might be trying to figure themselves out or figure their type out or compare a few types against each other or look at their friend and go, is that person a one or a four? I find that the holy idea and the fixation are just they just zero into the heart of the matter.
Yes. Yes. Love it. Yes. It's so interesting that you asked this specific question, because in my book, I only made room for one tiny Enneagram primer, because most of my book is like devotional application, right? The primer focuses in on the holy ideas.
Like, oh, wow.
Yes. So because to me, it is the essence of this. And so I want to start with this idea that going back to the circle of wholeness, we can start here. So if you look at the circle of wholeness, the Enneagram of Holy Ideas, as taught by A.H. Almas, whose real name is Hamid Ali, is basically this idea that if reality is like infinite intelligence, ideas, right? Infinite ideas, but ideas that have life, then we, based on our Enneagram type, have lost sight of one face of that reality. And that's one facet of that truth. And that facet that we lost sight of, not the one we have the most, the one we lost sight of, is our holy idea. And so I can go around the circle of the Enneagram to explore that for each of the types as I understand it. You know, so for the type one has lost sight of the holy idea of holy perfection that says that everything that is like fundamentally good. Perfect, even like beautiful, right? There's this even like a spiritual knowing at that level. Having lost sight of that, the person actually creates a personality type structure that's like, how am I going to survive in the world? Well, guess what? I'm going to focus on making things good because good is not naturally here. So the mental fixation or habit of the type one is rooted in this frustrated seeking, you know, of like, oh, there are things that are wrong and you're wondering why things are always wrong, but you've developed a mental fixation to actually look for what's wrong so you can fix it with the benevolent hope that you will then one day perfect all of reality. Ugh. Right? So it comes from that.
That's very sweet.
Yes. Right? Go ahead, Cassidy.
I just want to unearth just this, the overarching idea that the holy idea is not the thing that belongs to that type. It's the thing that that type is blind to or has lost sight of. I can't wait to hear the rest. That's all. I just want to keep lifting up that idea because that feels new to me in terms of my understanding of it. I've heard the term like blind spot or blind, you know, and I don't know if this is the same thing, but I really love that idea. That's all. Continue.
Yeah.
I'm in.
But you also reminded me, A Course in Miracles has the saying that the ego's mantra is seek, but do not find.
That's fun.
So, but if you think about it, if I lost sight of something fundamental, essential, but I keep looking to the world to find it.
Right.
Even going back to that analogy of the circle, it's like you're on the circle and you're looking out rather than inward.
Yeah.
Seek, but do not find. And it's like you've lost sight of this and you're still searching for it out there. And so all of us are searching in some way out in the world for what we can only find inside ourselves. So that's what your comment brought up for me, Cassidy.
Yeah.
So the two. Okay. Lost sight of the whole idea of holy will. And as a result of that, has a fixation called flattery. Now, it might take a few steps to go from one to the other here. So holy will is like this idea that the wants, the desires of the universe are all being met. Like there's a wanting, a will of the universe that is being met because it's one universal will. The two's like, it's not. I better take things into my own hands, right? And so the two's like, I'm going to meet your wants. like wants aren't just naturally met. Like I've got to take matters into my own hands. So there's this, but there's a reverse psychology regarding the two, right? It's sort of like, I'm not worthy, but if I give to you, you'll give back to me. That's how I'll get my needs want. So the flattery of the two, which it's not just the verb or action of flattery. It's a stance of, hi, like, do you like me? You know, like of people pleasing. It's a stance of being outward gazing to uplift you in hopes that somehow I will get my needs met, right? We know this never happens, right? The turning out doesn't work again. And so, but that's where the fixation happens. And so why, you know, Katie, you were talking about like this feeling so core. Yes. And this is why so many behavioral descriptions of type, they can go one way or another. You could do a lot of different behaviors in order to meet this need. But what defines the two is something about this being so core to this, like you just operate based on this belief that your needs aren't going to be met. And so this is the strategy you have to adopt. You don't think, oh, I'm going to go out there and flatter people to get me what I want. I just have an implied belief that like, it's not going to be me. So there's something that I have to offer to others, right? And so there's something in that stance that can result in a multitude of different behaviors or strategies for manipulating and seducing that ends up in the description of the two.
We have a friend and a dear friend who we both love and adore and follower of the podcast. Like one of our, she's one of our caller-inners and just loves, has been there with us from the beginning, who is the two-iest two that has ever two'd from my perspective. And I'm thinking of you, Fontana, as we hear this, because this, I mean, Cass, you know what I?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just delightful. It's delightful. It's like the Enneagram just continues to just, in the same way that we talk a lot here on about human design, because I'm a bit of a human design student and teacher. And so in the same way that for me, human design just unfolds its truths in layers of that you can't believe are so accurate. The Enneagram as well. This is why these are the two systems I give any F's about at this point. It's because they're so articulate. Like, that is the you just described Fontana Butterfield and she's not here. Isn't that amazing how the Enneagram?
Yes. Oh, and that reminds me, same thing with couples, right? Like, if someone brought in their partner and they happen to know their type, and I turned to them, I was like, oh, and these are the likely of your, you know, of what's happening between the person's soul. They're like, oh my God, like you, it's like you sat in our last conversation. so exactly. Yes.
Well, and the other thing is the power of knowledge and understanding. Like, I've used the example, so I won't go into detail of it, but on this podcast of like trying to talk to somebody, like working through with a partner, a problem or an issue that they're having and trying to be there for them, but doing it from the perspective of your type rather than theirs
yeah.
is really hard. Like, rather than going, oh, what is their blind spot that I need to help right. them see, rather than what would I need to hear? Doesn't matter.
Cass and I have another mutual friend who is a 9, and Cassidy's a 3, and I'm an 8. And we were talking about how I was trying to support and nurture our 9 friend. And I listened to myself just 8 all over them. I was like, here's how you gotta do it. And it was like the most exactly what I would have needed. Useless to the 9. Useless.
Rather than saying, you know, what you want matters.
Oh,
well, I've learned.
Yeah.
But in the beginning,
yeah.
In the beginning, I'm just like, well, you know, speak up. Just tell them. Just get in their face. What are you gonna? And they're like, that's the hardest thing I could ever think of. I don't even know what I want. What would I say?
Right.
And I don't want to be impolite and I feel very shy. And I'm like, just get over that. Just let it go. It's fine. Push forward. Nope.
Yeah. Huh? So this is really great because, yeah, already I'm like, oh, the 2, right. That's what that they can't see that.
Yes.
And so they're constantly striving for that.
Yes.
And that's behind all the different levels of healthy and unhealthy behavior that they are engaging in.
I'm excited about the 3 because you're both 3s.
Yeah. We got a couple of 3s here.
Yes. The good news is that we do start to see it. And so I want to give some hope there.
Okay, like, of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
We self see it. But we also need accountability because, I mean, well, this is a good time to go into the 3s who are tend to be self-deceptive. We don't know it. We don't know that we're lying to ourselves, right? So I'll start with that. Okay, so let's go back. We could say a lot on that, but the holy idea is holy law and holy hope. So there's kind of a blend of these two holy ideas of like the activity of the universe is just moving along, right? As one, there is one activity flowing in the universe. 3's like, if I don't do it, it's not going to happen, or it's not going to happen well, right? You know, it's like the positive, that's the hopefulness. So the 3 believes it's a separate doer. Like somehow, like imagine it's like somehow you don't, the wave thinks, oh, I pushed myself up when it was the whole movement of the ocean that moves the wave, right? The 3 is like, I did it, right? So, but the belief is that I've actually separated from the ocean, right? And I'm like trying to make myself do things. And so the efforting of the 3 comes from this sense of separation from that activity. And so the fixation happens in terms of like the deceit, the lack of authenticity of the 3 comes from this, the core issue of personhood being separate from the universe, if you will. And so you can kind of look at that because 3s really embody this notion of like being a separate person. Like there's something about that. So how do
what's the idea, the holy idea for the 3?
Oh, holy law and holy hope.
And that means again, what?
Oh, so the ideas together. I'm sorry. Did I just say, holy law and holy hope. So the idea is that holy law is the law of the universe. I know it's not the word activity. But it's as if the law of the universe is that the activity of the universe is just chugging along. Like there's just one activity, just like there's only one will for the 2. There's one activity of life.
Oh, I see. That's okay. That's what's been forgotten by the 3.
Yes. Like lost sight of, there's a disconnection from the movement of life. And so the 3 is like, I've got to do it. Right. There's this like pumping up, you know, by your own bootstraps kind of sense, you know, and along with that, there's this identification with being not only do I got to do it and do it well, but like I'm a doer. Like that's, it becomes like identity in threeness. There's something about that that's unlike other types. It's really hard for us to detach from this. And so whatever my role is, the three identifies with. So the self, the seat of the three kind of comes into play here in the mental fixation of whatever your role is, you confuse as who you are. No sense of being outside of that. And I know these are really abstract concepts. That's why, you know, like if any personal examples, I'm happy to, you know, happy to share. But, you know, what's the famous quote for threes? It's like work, like fun is fun, but work is fun. Like this idea that like work is more fun than fun. That's the quote. Work is more fun. And why? Why? So it's not just like that might be true for a lot of threes. There's a sense of like who I am. I get the lift from my work, right? From what I do. But like, what's the deeper reason for that? Because it like settles something deep inside. It becomes the proxy for the belief that I am part of the activity of the universe. It's like we all copy that, right? Being. Yeah. So there's a confusion. So for the three, oh, we could talk about this at the end if we have time, but like all the salve for each type, you know, but like for the three, cultivating presence of being, of being purposeless being. So yeah, I could feel the pain, the distress of that. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the, that one. I was sort of ruminating. It's fun. Just as a three, as you were going through it, I couldn't, you were saying words and I could not hear them. I was literally going, nope, don't get it. Don't get it. Don't get it. Like that's how blind the blind spot is. But until it finally crystallized, it took a moment. But the idea that we have to do,
right,
because the universe isn't doing, and that I'm the one who has to do it.
Yes.
Not just that it needs doing, but I'm the one who has to do it, because clearly that's what has to happen. It's so dumb. It's so wrong, but it's just like, anyway, thank you. Go on. Cultivating purposeless being.
Yes. And for most threes, I've worked with people, coached with people, where the first thing was, this is such a radical notion, Yen. This is such a radical idea. Give me a break. And, you know, next session, we'll talk about it. Just like, it's so antithetical because I know, I personally, like, I'm always like, what's the purpose of this? What's the purpose of this? If there's no purpose, we are not doing it. Like, you mean just sheer joy is not like a thing, right? You know, like there isn't just an organic joy. There's like a purpose toward a goal, blah, 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 blah. And like that, ooh, that feeds me. But, so the antidote to that is the cultivation of like this contemplative presence, which is primarily the spiritual practices I teach in Evolving Enneagram. It's like, these are all the antidotes, right? This contemplative presence, practicing offsetting the pull of that mental fixation of doing the things that uphold your idea of yourself, right? The role or the image that you want to put out and secure, right? If it gets a little fragile or a little messy or, right, you know, like you got to put it back up and put it together, right? It's a lot of work, right? But the healing power of letting that down. And it's like, because all that work is to try to feel worthy, right? For the three, of the belief in earned worth. Again, we're kind of going a little bit beyond, you know, the mental fixation teaching, but like this practical piece about moving from earned worth to inherent worth. And all that striving moves us further away. Because even if we get that and we succeed, we think that's why we're loved. That's why we're valued. And if we stop providing value, we won't be valued.
Yep.
Yeah.
I would love to sit and talk about the three for the next 2 hours because it's so good. I love it so much. But we should, just in the interest of time, let's push on to the rest of them. Thank you so much.
Yeah, you bet. So for the type four, it's the holy idea of holy origin. And or like, again, holy meaning almost like there's a oneness of origin. And if source is one, nothing has plopped out of that oneness. Nothing has separated from that. But the four believes that it has. So it's like, oh crap, now I need to be special or something. You know, like now, like how else am I going to get the goods of life, right? Like, and so that also speaks to that sense of like something deeply and profoundly missing that the four looks for in the world, you know, and melancholy is the fixation of the four. And it's like that longing for something I cannot name, right? That like it seems to be somewhere else, right? Never here. And so it looks for it in the world. It's like, and so there's this idea that if it's always somewhere else or often in the past for the four, why look here? So they never look here in the present moment where all good and gratitude and appreciation and presence flows. The strategy keeps you looking in a place you'll never find it. So that melancholy, but being that like sense that something's lost, but isn't really. It's that my attention to what is here is lost as a result. So yeah, so that's the short version. I'll keep it short, come on four, and then we can come back if we have time. You know, and the four, the five, it's actually two different holy ideas, holy omniscience and holy transparency. And the five haven't really lost sight of holy omniscience. That's the more obvious one for those who know about the five. It's like the infinite knowing, the wisdom of the universe. It's fully available right here and now. I don't know that. You bet I'm going to do my research. You bet I'm going to strive to know what I think I need to know. And that's different.
Oh,
am I right?
These fives. My God, these fives.
Oh, and you've got a line to five. And the special.
I know, girl. The suffering of the five, like, I feel like, just to interrupt briefly, I want to add something that what you're saying makes me think of is, I'm not sure what I think this is a function of just having a lot of trauma. Like, I have a lot of trauma, more than the average bear, from a very, very young age. I feel like in my development, I've had to go through integrating and processing the holy idea and fixation of each number, which sounds like a very nine thing of me. I've always had a leaning toward the nine, but definitely seated in the eight. So it's like probably the wing or whatever. It used to not be, but now it seems to be. Anyway, each piece you talk about, I'm like, yeah, I went through that. I did that. And so it's funny because it makes me think of like, yep, did that, did that, did that, did that. Then you get to the eight and I go, well, I'll be working on that forever. Like that one is harder. It's objectively harder, but it's just harder for me because it's my type. But I think that it speaks to your point about the unity consciousness of the whole thing of like, we're all on a certain level dealing with all of these integration points potentially, or we can be if we're looking and paying attention, is that we're all going to deal with some level of flattery and vanity and I have to do it and separation. And these are all the things you meet on the journey of awakening anyway. But then there usually is one or two that are extra resonant, right? Because we're oriented that way.
Right. And I so appreciate you bringing that up. First of all, kudos to you for this journey of healing. I mean, that's clearly overflowed into the people that you're in relationship with, right? You could hear that. Like that.
Yeah, it's been it's my whole life. But what are you going to do? What are you going to do?
Just here we are. Just going to keep doing it.
Keep doing it one day at a time. No, but thank you. I appreciate it. Yeah.
It's beautiful. And it reminds me also that one of my core principles and practices, that of compassion, because I used to whip myself into shape. And I'm like, that didn't actually work.
Doesn't work. Yeah.
But when I'm actually in touch with how hard it is to process my journey, like how difficult it is for me to believe that, oh, if I'm not offering you some value, that I'm lovable or that I'm worthy, that's a big leap for me. You
for
know,
sure.
That's grown over time. So I don't try to like lean into the five and go, oh, I see that. It's more of like, if I can feel how hard that is, then I see if I'm frustrated with a five's endless, you know, rabbit hole seeking.
Yes.
I just really identify. I'm like, oh.
Of course, the mercy. I happen to have a five dad and I've just watched him his whole life. Like, luckily for him, he gains a lot of egoic gratification from like the endless research of all things literally that exist. And he loves it. And he lives in his little room and he spins down his little holes and it makes him happy. He has this like big, beautiful home, but he lives in one little room and he's just taking every Stanford science course that ever was. And he's happy, according to him. But then it's just, I watch the torture of it and the sort of rat race of it. And I have deep empathy for it because he, and the way he'll talk about it, it's like, he's not a dude on a spiritual path per se. So he would talk about it just like, I can just feel the pain in it. And I just love him. And it's like, oh, dad, you never got past that one, did you? But he's okay. He's doing him. Anyway, so the five.
Yeah. So definitely. So we just talked about holy omniscience. There's also holy transparency. And we don't talk about that as much. We hear more about the omniscience piece for the five, but it's a blend of the two. And holy transparency is related to sort of like your sense of separation with the world. If you think about it, like this notion of the fluidity of boundaries, that most people can find some organic movement of that. And fives are like, island, I'm an island over here. Like they're like, it's very, so you think about being castled as a five, isn't as much connection to that. So you can see how without that, it's sort of like, well, I'm over here, so I better hoard whatever resources I think I have, you know, like basically. And so the fixation of the five, you know, there is that like focus on scarcity, right? So that is the, it's because I'm not sitting in this wellspring of infinite abundance. Like, if anything, it's over there and I have to cross a whole freaking bridge and the people over there and people are messy and I don't know if I want to deal with that. And I don't have the energy because I already believe in lack and limited resources. And so what am I going to do? You know, it's like one time I did a Sunday sermon on the type five, and I described it as, it's like you're inside your castle and you're like, instead of going out there and living the life, you're reading picture books about the world outside the castle, right? To get as close to that experience as possible, not understanding that you are not reaping the fullness of being just like all other types. We're not picking on the fives here in nine different ways, right?
That makes me think of my father, also a five, a very different five than Katie's father, who in the books that he's written and stuff like that, he talks about these two peak experiences, which were when he was released to the all that is and became basically unity consciousness for a brief period of time. And literally every damn thing he has done his entire life of research has been an attempt to return to that.
Wow.
So he lost it, but he knows it's there.
Wow.
And so his blindness is from a slightly different viewpoint, because it's like, I know that I have holy transcendence or holy, yeah, it was
transparency. Yes.
I understand holy transparency because I have experienced it.
Wow. That's almost more
but
painful.
But I can't get it.
Yeah. It's almost
again.
More painful.
And he has spent his whole life trying to get that meal.
Aww.
Yeah. And so his research is 100% in service to that. But it is also like the probably where it comes into conflict is that that's not where it is.
Right. Right. Yes. Yes. In the path of, for all nine types, the path of striving like that versus, I mean, when I talked about contemplation earlier, there is a path of opening, a path of receptivity, right? It's very different. And so we all strive in different ways. Like even the nines, you know, or who are accused of not striving, but there's a different way, there's a different thing they strive toward. So, yeah. Yeah. Wow. That's
so tough. How about the six?
Okay. So the six has lost sight of the holy ideas of holy strength and holy faith. And holy faith is this knowing that spirit is the ground of being and it like the foundation of being. And so, and it's infinite and invisible. And related to that, holy strength comes from, if I'm grounded in this infinite as the ground of my being, then it's like I have all the energy, all the wisdom, whatever I need to show up in life, right? The six feels really fragile. The ground is shifty. There's no like spiritual solid ground of anything. So I'm going to spend my whole life, depending on my subtype, seeking for security in something. See that? Like how that correlates. Every single way the personality seeks is related to the loss of the holy idea, right? Like seek, but do not find in this direction, right? And so that fixation called cowardice. Oh, by the way, to give credit, Oscar Ichazo was the person who coined all these originally. And also originally had a different language other than English as his primary language. So some of these really do require interpretation, like cowardice. I mean, you know, our sixes, do they live more cowardly than others? Not the ones I've actually seen. But when we think of it as a mental fixation, we can look at it as a mental fixation of planning against future harm or danger. The mind is fixated in a way to prevent, to be wary, to be vigilant against future danger. So that's kind of how the fixation happens, right? Because there's no ground. I'm not sure. I'm not certain. So we better try to secure. So we need to look ahead and we need to stay vigilant, right? You know, the eyes of even lots of sixes, you'll see like there's like a scanning energy around it, right? About why, like what happens, right? And it can show up. Some sixes, you know, they focus more on their relationships being secure, right? As the ground, you're going to find it there. For some, it's belief system. So it's not always like the same thing. But if fundamentally you're not connected to your spiritual knowing that there is a spiritual ground of being, there is nothing you find in the world that will ever help you to feel secure.
Yeah, for sure. I have a number of six friends I can think of. I'm like, yep, that's what they're doing. It's the notion of, you were saying a minute ago, striving as a kind of, I would almost frame it like a kind of central challenge or a central delusion that all humans can fall into. It's like anytime when I saw that in my, I was in Sufi school. I went to a 4-year Sufi healing school. And that was the first of three healing schools I attended in the, there was a moment in Sufi school where I went, oh, anything I do that is a striving. So I have to be honest enough and in touch with myself enough and present enough to be able to see, am I striving for approval? Am I striving for connection? Am I striving, even striving for healthy things? Am I striving for health? Boy, people can get crazy in the striving toward health. You know, that can be the most toxic one in certain ways. Am I striving for intimacy? Am I whatever they're striving towards? Striving is the place to sit into and bring, as you're talking about, the contemplative practice, or in my words, the divine light, or in anybody, whatever, whatever processing we can do around the place inside the body that says, like, I gotta get there. I'm striving toward blank. All of a sudden, the entire knot unravels, the knot of tension that we think is who we are. And so many people, the identity becomes this tension point, this tension of this knotted up tension. And we're like, that's me, because I recognize that knot of tension. When if you unravel it, people are afraid to unravel the knot of tension because there's nothing there. And then who am I? Which of course you can relate to as a three, because that's such a common idea for the three. There's nothing in here. But I think every number goes through that, every type of person, because why would you want to de-identify with everything? And the answer in my case is, when you have enough pain, you start to understand that under all the pain is a striving towards something that is creating all the other pain. So I may as well unravel it. And then here we are, where there's no identity and it's just like spaciousness. And I'll tell you, there has been, I want to say this because I say that like it's so easy or something. There's been like real layers of, what the fuck do I do with myself now? Now that there is no, there's nothing in here to hold on to. There's no lifeboat. There's no life jacket. And for me, the answer comes back to something we call strategy and authority in human design, where I just trust that, like, I'll just live in response and I'll trust the seat of consciousness and I'll try to be as vulnerable and non-vengeancy as I can. One moment at a time, the unfurling unfurls. But when you put that to people to try to, you know this better than anyone as a teacher of this and as a reverend, if you put the notion of ego death to people and they really start to understand what it's actually going to look like and feel like, you get a lot of pushback. Because it's not the easiest thing or the most comfortable thing to live with no life raft until it is.
Yes. Yes.
Does that make sense at all?
Oh, yeah. What a beautiful journey you've been on. Yeah. And right before you said death, I was like, that's what I was going to talk about, the egoic death. I was like, that's what you were describing, right? To die before you die. The old spiritual and religious traditions all speak to this need. And again, not a literal death, but from an Enneagram perspective, a death to who we thought we were.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which brings us beautifully to the seven.
Okay. So for the seven has lost sight of the holy idea of like holy plan. And so the mental fixation is planning. Go figure. Really direct correlation there. It's easy to see that one. So, but what, I mean, it's also holy wisdom and holy plan. There's a mix of this. Like there's an intelligence of the universe unfolding for blessing and for good. And the seven's like, nah, I'm going to take good. I'm going to take this happy stuff into my own hands. I don't trust that things are going to go well unless I neurotically think about it, right?
Scott Lifton.
Scott Lifton. Sitting there going, Scott, he's also a guest on the podcast. Oh, he knows we talk about it.
Oh, awesome. Hi, Scott. Yes. And so you can think about it as, okay, what sevens confuse is when they hear a plan, they're like, oh, I'm not good at planning. I'm like, no, this is not about whether you're good at it. It's about whether you're mentally obsessed with thinking. And if you're not, it's almost like if you're sitting in a room and you're bored, you're going to mentally imagine things and think about future options and things. That's what we mean by planning, right? There's a need to fill that vacuum, the perceived vacuum of existence, rather than go deeper into it. From the personality's point of view, it was like, we're not going here. We're not going to go into this desert terrain, which is what the seven can feel like inside when they first begin to get silent, right? No, we're going to fill it with exciting plans and thoughts. We're going to fill it with a freaking amusement park inside my head, right? If I can, right? Or whatever ideas will keep me entertained, if you will. So it's not just the future, but that's also related to, so you could see in every seven, there's like it's almost like an opportunistic, like we're trying to figure out how to make sure I'm going to be okay later, right? You could hear that. Sevens are self-referencing in that way, you know, and definitely. So twos are other referencing. This is the same thing. We're not saying one is better than the other, you know, but sevens just happen to take the strategy of I'll be like, no one's going to come and like make this happen for me. I'm going to take care of myself. When I teach the Enneagram, I've in the past taught the seven with a picture of a kid crawling out of the crib. It's like, rather than crying and waiting for the mom, it's like, I'm just going to crawl out of this crib and go find it for myself. go make it. In fact, the seven often vacations and searches the world for this, like, right? Like experience. And so there's this idea. It's like none of it being bad. It's just like, oh, it's just misguided. It won't get you there. It won't get you right. Looking for because that, yeah.
And that's the trap of the mind and the personality and the ego is we always think if I listen to it, I'll get the thing I'm looking for. And then it just circle, 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 snake eating its tail.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And so, and the problem with most sevens, I mean, a very concrete example that many can identify with is that you plan a vacation and then you're on the vacation planning your next vacation. You know, like
Scott Lifton. Literally Scott Lifton.
Be here now.
It's painful, right? But when the type is in pain and it doesn't have a spiritual path, what does it do? It doubles down on its, right? It's like, oh no, it must be the next vacation. I just got the country wrong. Let's go to Africa, right? Not my whole strategy is wrong, right? So that we double down on it. The three's like, well, I'll just work harder. Like I don't feel loved yet, but I'll just work harder. Like, so I'll do more. Like maybe it's the next goal, you know? And yeah, endless quest. So the eight has lost sight of the holy idea of holy truth.
What do you mean?
And oh yeah, what we mean by that? The holy truth says all is one. There is no good guys versus bad guys. No one is against you. Those are some of the implications. Yes.
Nuh-uh.
Yeah, right. Yeah. So and if that's true, you don't have to be so hard. But if what you believe is true, you know, and it's like good and bad, black and white, us versus them, no wonder you have to be hard and strong all the time, right? And there's something about the sensitivity to that holy idea. So all types have kind of the sensitivity to their holy idea that is like, oh, well, so black and white, I'll correct that. I'll take justice into my own hands. Vengeance is a taking of justice. That vengeance is the word fixation of the eight. There's like this quest, this deep and meaningful and valid quest for justice.
And here it is, if I may. Cassidy, we came back to the story I told. Remember I said, so Nian, we have a thing where we gather, he and I, and we chat before the guest comes on when we have a guest. And miraculously, whatever we will talk about the randomest stuff, and it will always have resonance somewhere in when the guest comes on. And here it is in my number. So I told a story briefly. I won't bore you with it, but I told a story I posed a question to the listening audience. Katie's choice to do X, does she regret it? And it was a choice where I told a friend of mine something his wife told me about how she felt about him, and it ended their marriage. And that was absolutely from a sense of, this is unjust. She feels this way about him. He has to know, because it's on me to bring justice to the fore. And they broke up, and then all kinds of chaos ensued. But what's fun to about it, to look at, and now I see, Cass, why this was, why I wanted to bring that story up, is because there's a way that you could look at that story and go, no, that was a generosity you did. You did that guy a favor because you brought him into truth. You told him the truth. But then you ask the question, why am I still thinking about this 30 years later or 20 years later? And the answer is, there is still a question inside of me of like, was it really my job to bring justice to them? There are two people over there. I'm not the justice mayor. I'm not the boss of justice on planet Earth, but boy, did I fucking feel like it in that dynamic. And so now I'm sort of like, huh, it's come up lately as I'm doing whatever 90th layer of heart healing I'm always doing. But like, it's like, I'm not quite sure anymore.
Wow.
And I don't feel bad about it. I have a lot of mercy for like, I see where I was coming from. And it was actually like, I cared a lot about my friend and I wanted him to be, blah, blah. But it's a fun one to think about because going forward, I just go, I'd probably take a deep breath if this were now and say like, dear universe, please bring for them whatever they need on their journey. I shan't insert myself into this one because I'm not in charge of this. Who's to say what the justice is? But boy, was I certain. I was so certain.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I love hearing that you bring mercy to how you're holding it today, because that's a really tender kind of experience, you know? And as you shared it, that was actually the word tenderness that came up for me around how different is that stance of tenderness that allows whatever needs to fall into place. You know, there's a heart space within the word tenderness as well that is invaluable for the eight, because so it isn't then, right, as you know, but it's the moment of how you're holding now that is most relevant, right? Like what is up for me now is what comes up. And then the next thing that came up for me around that is this beauty of the virtue of innocence that is the eight's virtue coming into play.
Yeah, I mean, when I learned that idea, that the sort of vengeance, innocence, duality, paradigm, whatever we want to call it, like it was so heart-shattering. Because it was so clear to me, that's why I've done everything, is the innocence was robbed of me. It was taken really young. And of course, if it were taken in such a brutal, heartless, abusive way, I'm going to seek for justice, of course, until it's safe to practice tenderness and to go to that vulnerable place. It wasn't safe for me for a long time. And that's been a lifelong journey to get to where, I mean, yesterday at an argument with my beloved partner, where the only way the argument ended was I broke down sobbing because I touched into this like really tender place. And then we just let me calm down. And then later on, I realized there just wasn't a problem. There wasn't a problem. We were fighting about not a thing. There was nothing there. It was just this particular layer of tenderness was protected by such a hard, angry, scared protector part, to speak in parts work speak, who just was like, nah, ah, ah, ah. And then it was just like, she went away and I just, this part just went, ah, 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 ah. And then we both sort of, once I was calm, laughed and went like, what were we fighting about? Nothing, because it was just that dynamic within me that was just up, operating.
Yes, yes, yes.
And the tenderness, that's so good. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's so amazing that you have access to that. And it does, it gifts the whole world. You're opening to that tenderness because it gifts other people the opportunity to meet you, to be in contact with you. And I would say that the one thing I would add to that is that when you were talking about the loss of innocence, my understanding is that you were talking about in a very worldly and very visceral and very traumatic way, right? And my thought inside was just like the holy idea, that innocence at the core level of being was never taken from her, you know?
Well, I had to re-meet it.
Yes, exactly.
I separated from it to survive. And then when I've had to re-meet it and re-meet it and re-meet it and go, oh, right. It's just softness and tenderness. And I think, you know, I know we all can just stay on our own type forever, but something that I feel is important to say, because so many people in the world are so afraid of eights for such good reason, because an eight who can't find the tenderness, I mean, we're scary. We can be very scary because it's the amount of strength required to protect the amount of tenderness in there. Until you have safety to reconnect with that tenderness, all there is that protective, justice-seeking, heat-seeking rage missile. That's all there is.
Yes.
And so when you encounter an eight in the wild, it's like, good luck to you. I turn the other way if I meet an eight. I'm like, ooh, not today.
Eight in the wild.
But anyway, it's a hard one only because the very thing, it's also, we live in a culture where, like, you guys as the three, right? You get all this praise, all this ego praise for how hard you work so hard. Look how hardworking. You're so smart and good and hardworking. We admire you. And that's my, and then the eight is like, we're in positions of leadership and we're so strong. And how are you so strong? And you just were so strong. And it's like, I'm dying inside. And you think, and it's a, so when we get praised from the outer world for the challenges of the type or the fixation of the type, that's another layer that makes it challenging to sink into whatever's behind it that would allow us to soften our grip on it.
Well, so if we ever talk again, I want to talk about the world's shadows as expressed through the Enneagram, like, because touching on this, because I actually think it's both for three. We happen to be threes and eights. I don't think, you know, like, the world, is the world picking on us? No, but because we're both assertive types, threes and eights, that there is something about how it's more visible in the world, right? You know, also then a rejection, when people see abuses of power, they can often disown their own power. And yet we need people to own their own power for the world to be in love, right?
Yeah.
So the integration and welcoming of the eight energy is vital to our belief. Mm. Yes. It's a whole nother, you know, but yes, because it's been shadowed and cast aside because, yes, there's unhealthy elements of eight, but also disowned power within people's being, right?
100%.
That then makes the eights even feel more powerful and power over me versus, like, I have my own power, right? So 100%, that's important. And then, you know, I can go off on the three energy as well. But, you know, let's get to the nine.
Let's get to the nine, because it would be ironic if we didn't get to the nine because they don't matter and they don't count, right? That's what they're afraid of.
They don't even exist. So they let's don't just even skip exist. It. Let's skip just it. Skip.
I love my nines. Hello,
nines. God, I love them.
We've
so
been
much.
So patient. They've been like, oh, God, we're last again. They're like, you know?
So terrible.
So we're really on you. But truly, nines have lost sight of the holy idea of holy love. And love, I mean, I think love as it's not as an emotional affect, but love as union or communion, love as oneness. So if you think about it, nines imitate, all the types are trying to find their thing. Nines imitate oneness through their merging activities.
Mm.
Trying to duplicate that by merging, going with the flow, whether it's with a partner, whether it's with the couch, you know, or the creature comforts, whatever it is, whether it's with the group, depending on, you know, subtypes. But that's one way. It's like they're trying. It's like, okay, I'm separate. Also, yes, nines are so positive. They're like, oh, yes, the universe is love. But somehow, like, everything is love. Well, the sun shines, but it doesn't shine on me. Like, that's the belief, right? The sun shines everywhere. Well, except for me, right? I don't matter. So I'm going to actually attach to things that matter as well. So that's one strategy, right?
Mm.
The partner's needs might seem more important. And so you can attach to that and then be connected to that. And that's why one reason, oh my God, I heard someone share once in a way that was so profound to me about conflict. Like, it wasn't, it's annoying when people say, well, I don't like conflict. I must be a nine. A lot of people don't like conflict.
Nobody likes conflict at first, please.
So, but the sense of, you know, nines being body types, almost like conflict separates you. And if your value, your sense of self was tied to this thing that you're being pulled away from, the person floating, you're orbiting in outer space right now, that kind of lostness, because you are not the center of your life. Mm-hmm. The center of gravity is not inside. And so I had so much more compassion for nines, understanding like disconnection from people related to conflict as a result of just that hearing of like what it means. It's like a big deal. It's not something little, I don't like it. It's something like I am completely lost. And now I better latch onto something else because heaven forbid, I have to actually find my own identity now, you know, like that fixation. And then so we go into the fixation of laziness is the term. And it's not necessarily, sometimes it is, but it's not necessarily laziness of activity, but it's laziness of attention to your personal needs, wants, your personhood, essentially. I'm not important, says the nine. And I don't really want to know. If I went down there, I would actually probably feel the pain of feeling deeply unimportant. But instead, I don't want to verify it. So I'll just kind of live my life like up here. I'm never going to go down there. So if I don't go down there, I'm never going to find out what I really want. I'm not going to know myself in a way where I can actually belong in the world, right? You know, and that a lot of nines are like, wonder why they're overlooked. It's like you tried to not be seen, right? Not consciously usually hiding, but you merge with the wallpaper. You do what it takes to like not show up in that separateness that makes you feel like I'm going to be on my own over here. Oh, but you're your own freaking big planet. You're not just something orbiting another planet, right? But the nine doesn't really know that. And so it tries to attach to whether it's comfort, if you're self-prezzy, you know, or like people and relationships and not break from that, you know? So,
there's a way that like the nine has a real special place in my heart, I think, because of being such a self-prez eight that I just go, oh God, if you couldn't individuate and you couldn't know what, like I did all this work just to know what's me and what I need so I could speak up for it. And then I'd be safe. Like if you don't have that, how are you functioning every day? And then it makes the answer is like differently from you, Katie, differently. Like they're doing a whole different thing. And I live with one. And it's just, I just watch him and I go, oh,
yeah,
wow, you got through a day? You're all right? And he's like, I'm fine. I'm like,
you
okay.
Ate, you bathed, you fed yourself, you did all those things.
Yeah, so amazing that just the sheer difference between some of the types.
Yes, it is true. Like what we value, like looking through the lens of that, I definitely resonate with the sense, you know, being a three, you know, and having like, activity being part of my life, you know, just like, oh yeah, that's a good thing that you can spend a whole day doing nothing. Okay. You know, like that. And understanding that that's so my bias, right? That's so the lens of like, that would be horrible, right? From the traditional personality lens.
Totally.
Of the eight, right?
Yep.
Where the nine's like, actually what you just did, all that sounds exhausting and like I wouldn't want to live anymore. But my life is like yours, you know?
Yeah.
You know, like how do we know? Like what's best in that? And that kind of goes back to your first story too, right? There is this, I think, along the spiritual journey and awakening to a deepening of our humility.
Yeah.
Of what we don't know, of what we really,
right.
We can stay open and curious about with respect to other people. I have guesses. I mean, I'm the, you know, quote expert. People come to me for, you know, counsel and this and that. And more and more, it's like that understanding of what I don't know, that if I listen deeply enough, though, that if I listen enough, they will reveal themselves to me in that space of sacred listening. You know? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You have been a delight. I'm so happy your people found us and reached out to me. Like, what a gift. I wish we had all the time in the world to talk with you more. And I, as you mentioned before, I'd love to have you back if that's something you want to do and talk about the shadow.
Oh, I would love to. I mean, you're such depthful interviewers. And I've been on quite a few interviews. So yes, I would love to.
Oh, great. I love it. Well, let's just say, just so we're clear, will you say your last name for me, please?
Vuong.
Vuong.
Oh, beautiful. Yeah.
Nhien Vuong wrote The Enneagram of the Soul.
It's coming out.
Oh, it's coming out. That's what this is all about. Keep an eye out for it. Website is evolvingenneagram.com. That's where you can find out more. Just, you know, doing the commercial, the three thing, which is, you know, make sure the package is beautiful here. Oh, anyway, thank you so much. What an absolute joy this has been.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm so glad. And everybody in Kansas City, go to the Unity Church.
Yeah.
Listen to Nian speak.
Oh, I'm not at a physical church, by the way. We never answered that.
Oh, no.
Yes. Evolving Enneagram. Oh, I can't believe I did it. So I'm low on the social three here, you know. So Evolving Enneagram is my ministry. We do everything online and we have weekly groups and all the things. But so yeah, Evolving Enneagram and the Enneagram of the Soul is my book where you can learn more about like this sort of deeper kind of take on the Enneagram.
Fantastic.
All right. Well, thank you so much and have a great, great day. Take care of you.
Bye.
Okay. Bye.
Bye. Do your work.
Do your work.
Okay. What are you asking for? All of the answers? Say what? All of the answers?
Yeah, all the answers. Hey guys, thanks for listening. We'd love to hear from you. Please email us with your questions so that we have questions to answer in the Akashic Records. Our email address is allanswerspod@gmail.com. That's allanswerspod@gmail.com. And if you'd like to find us on Facebook or Twitter, it's @allanswerspod. Thank you.
Sorry, everyone who has to edit out this long pause. Leslie, Desmond, we love you.
Mixed and edited by Desmond McNeese for We Mixed It, LLC. Go to whatsoundsawesome.com.